I think one of the reasons that the podcast is proving to be popular is that most of the stories follow that classic hero's journey narrative arc. You know it. Our hero, the founder, is dissatisfied with the status quo of their current situation. He or she then sets off on a bold journey of discovery, starts a company, and then is faced with insurmountable problems, huge challenges, fierce obstacles, fire-breathing dragons, before eventually, and against all the odds, finds success, sells their business, and lives happily ever after. Not quite like that, but you know what I mean. I mean, if you watch almost any Hollywood film or Pixar movie, you'll see a version of this story unfold broadly along these lines. And today's real-life story begins by following that classic hero's journey, but there's a definite twist in this tale. My guest, Neil Simpson, is very well known in the creative advertising sector and founded a leading agency called The Corner. With his business partners, he built the company into one of the top independent agencies in the country, and so inevitably, buyers came knocking on his door. After one or two interesting but ultimately unsuccessful engagements, Neil and his partners agreed to proceed with the sale of their business to a larger corporate. What's interesting, and I think is a huge lesson for independently minded entrepreneurs, is recognizing that life after a sale, especially if you're locked into an earnout over several years, can be a challenge. The fact that you're no longer that creative, entrepreneurial, fast-moving business and are now a cog in a much larger wheel may not be to your liking. This conversation is packed with words of wisdom from someone who's pretty much done it all, from working in and ultimately leading large multinational companies to setting up and growing his own business, not once, but twice, before selling. And, well, you'll have to listen in to hear the full story. It's quite a tale. If you're a business owner or you advise and consult with business owners, giving 60 minutes of your time to listen to this conversation will be the best investment you make this week. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Mr. Neil Simpson. This is Alan Smith, and you are welcome to the Entrepreneur Transition Podcast. If you're looking for ideas and inspiration to guide you on your business and personal journey, you, my friend, have come to the right place. Neil Simpson, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Very well, Alan. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Now, you have got, from what I understand, you've got a very interesting experience and journey around the whole kind of entrepreneurial found a business, build a business, scale, exit, and life thereafter. And I'm really looking forward to kind of really chatting through that and unpacking your personal experiences. I think it's going to be very interesting for others, perhaps a year or two behind you on their own personal journey. But let's start where all good stories begin, right at the beginning. Take us back to how you got going in business, how the whole thing got started and set up.
It's going back away now, but unusually, compared to a lot of my friends at school, I landed on deciding I wanted a career in advertising, probably around the age of 17, which was very unusual. A lot of different factors that I won't bore you with. And so I decided to progress on that and was going to enter the industry straight away. I thought there's no point going to university and eventually got advised, go to university, get a degree, and then build your career, which I did do. And this is quite some time ago. And I think some of the entrepreneurs that you will speak to will be creating a new product or service in a sector that hasn't existed before and will therefore, regardless of their background experience, if they've got the passion for it and maybe a little understanding for it, they will launch. What I decided I wanted to do was to not only join advertising, but start my own advertising agency. That was my plan. But with a sector that already exists, it meant I realized quickly you've got to learn the ropes. You've got to learn your experience, do your time, so to speak, and build that connection and network of contacts before you'd be able to go and start your own agency. So it took some time for me to kind of realize my entrepreneurial desire, I suppose, and create an agency, which eventually I then created in 2012. But before then, I ended up building this experience and actually often say to people, careers, I don't know what you think. I found they're a bit like, there used to be a game called Frogger where you jumped around and went up a bit, and then sometimes you fell down and then you jumped up on a rail and you went up. And my I was naively thought, well, a career is linear. It's going to go that way and I'm going to map out the steps. And of course, it didn't work out that way. So I became a client. So because I work in creative advertising agency, and so then I sort of jumped ship during my career to be a client at one stage, which I hadn't planned, but in the end became wonderfully valuable experience for me as I built all that knowledge base before I launched my own business. So it didn't take a completely linear path. It took maybe longer than I thought, but I managed after many years to then start my own agency in 2012.
Very interesting. So what you're saying is you did have sort of an entrepreneurial ambition from the beginning, almost from sort of school, uni days, but you recognized because of your, and that's quite unusual. I certainly didn't know what I wanted to do. In fact, I still don't really know what I want to do when I grow up. But when you're at that age, you're pretty clear that was something that was obviously of interest to you. You want to build a career within the advertising profession. And then what you just realize that it's just too difficult to sort of do a startup from scratch. It's very, presumably very much a networked business. You need to know what you're doing, know who's involved, who to connect with, and so on. So what did you, who did you start with? Who did you start working with?
Corporates? Yeah. So when I started The Corner, who did we start with? Along the way.
Who were you working for before that? Just to sort of build career. Yeah.
I managed to get into a graduate trainee scheme in a variety of agencies. So there was at the time, some of the names have morphed and changed because that's the wonderful thing about the world of advertising. It used to be just the names of the partners on the door, and then they evolve, they sell, they merge, they get another partner, and so that there are lots of names. But a large network agency is one that's called Ogilvy. Some of your listeners may know that. A very creative agency called BBH. And then I was hired by one of my clients there, which is the point I made before about, you know, I didn't plan that. But I remember thinking, and maybe that's part of the entrepreneurial spirit, I remember thinking very quickly, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go with it. And I think definitely, I'm sure a lot of the entrepreneurs that listen and your listeners will understand, you do trust your instinct a lot in the world of being an entrepreneur, and you have to. And it's a confidence that comes there. And I've come across a lot of people who are very talented in their fields, but they're not cut out to be entrepreneurs. They're perhaps a little bit more cautious. And I'm not saying be reckless, but I definitely trusted my instinct and always have done a lot. And I think you absolutely need that in the world of being an entrepreneur. And so I trusted my instinct to decide, well, look, actually, I'm going to go. It was Coca-Cola. It was to go to their headquarters in Atlanta in the States. And it was a good job. And I just got on a plane and went with a little bag. And then that led to then getting another senior global client role at Adidas, which was great. My father used to say to me, he said, what are you doing today? I said, oh, well, we're talking about the footballers we're going to sign. And then I've got to get tickets to go to the World Cup later, and then there's a shoot we're doing with Anna Kournikova. He said, you haven't got a proper job, have you? And I always remember that.
Yeah,
I
thought, because
a man that loves sport was so envious. But that was a wonderful time, and again, building that experience.
Yeah.
Came back to the UK to work at Vodafone, again in a global marketing role. Very different organisation. Perhaps didn't place as much of an emphasis on creativity in the world of marketing, but had wonderful discipline and rigor about the way it took product to market, which I learned a lot about. And then, and it's interesting here because this is back to the entrepreneurial thing, I sort of came out of Vodafone and started a business. So I did actually start a business before I launched my own advertising agency. And it was a business called the PC Guys, which was working on home IT support for people. You may recall there was a period, I mean, we're going back now, probably mid-90s, where there were companies in the States like the Geek Squad. There were businesses coming up saying, look, everybody's got all this machinery at home and can't run their IT. And they can't rely on their business IT to support them. So we identified an opportunity, myself and a couple of ex-Vodafone colleagues, and launched this business. And that was interesting because obviously, again, I took an instinct to go with something. I still had that entrepreneurial itch. It was lovely to scratch when you see a market opportunity. But what I learned there, Alan, was interesting, was it was in a sector that I personally knew not a lot about. I mean, I couldn't come around and fix your IT. I mean, I hired a lot of engineers, and when we designed it, we got them out, we were doing bookings, etc. But I didn't have a lot of knowledge or passion for that. And that I think taught me. And eventually we got out there. We didn't lose any money. Funny enough, we sold it to we sold it to Tesco because they wanted to hire one of my partners. So they just bought the business on the back of it, which was important. And that taught me another thing. Everybody that had been involved didn't lose any money, got their money back. A couple of people made a tiny amount more, but basically everybody came out of it having had 2 years experience and enjoyment and didn't lose a penny on it, which I think was really important. We managed to deliver that for everyone.
Really good.
But I sat, it was important. And I sat in a room there, interesting, where they said, oh, hang on, you might, what's going to happen now? Well, this chap, your partner goes to work in this other job at Tesco and you will run this small business on your own. And I suddenly thought, it was a come to Jesus moment. I thought, what are you doing here? How did you get here? You don't want to be doing this. And that was an interesting moment when I sort of stepped back, reconsidered, and then went, get back into the world of advertising because that was your passion. Sorry, I went off a tangent there, but that's been the nature of my career.
No, that's really, really relevant. No, that's, what did you say? I mean, you say frogger, it's like kind of career snakes and ladders, isn't it? Sort of go up a ladder, then come slide down again, and then try again, do something different. So that's interesting. So what did you... those were the lessons that I think I took from that was that you should be in something that you know about and you're passionate about and want to spend more time with, as opposed to a functional role you think. Because no doubt there was a market for that. There still is. And sufficient enough to build a business, make a living and to sell it successfully. But you weren't loving it. And certainly if your partner or business partner was off doing something else and you were sort of on your own, you didn't have a lot of love for that sort of going forward. So... Having a passion for the job you're going to do and the industry or the profession that it's in clearly must be important to the entrepreneurial journey. Has been for you?
For me, 100% for me. Yeah. I don't know about other people, maybe different, but they were learnings. And, you know, interestingly, even just talking to you now about that, I'm realizing there are all those things were moments of learning before I then set up the business that I really wanted to set up. And even that point before about making sure that everybody was looked after and the care for your people as well, those sorts of things. You know, stumbling across those, I realize they're essential for whatever you're going to do and the people business. And that final point you made is interesting, but with your partners. If you do it with partners, you're bonded with those people. And if they're suddenly not going to be part of it, it's a totally different, isolated experience.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So, I mean, what was the timeline on this? You left. I mean, that's a huge move in itself. So you went from Vodafone, one of the biggest companies in the world, to a micro startup. In an industry you didn't know a lot about. You knew the sort of, I guess, some of the tech aspects from working for a sort of telecoms company. But what was that like? I mean, what were your family circumstances? Did you have kids in those days? Did you have
I did. I had a partner at the time and two sons who would have, you know, been early teens, I would guess, probably a bit younger. Actually younger than, six, seven, both of them. And I mean, that's a good point because, you know, what I knew I had set aside was enough to be able to isolate and put a ring fence around them to go, like, I can ensure that their education may be supported, that the family home is supported, that I could make sure there's a holiday a year. So their quality of life will not be affected. But I will therefore be able to still have a certain amount of time to go and explore this avenue that I want to sort of test myself in creating this business. And that's quite important. The reason you asked the question is that you don't want to put things that matter to you at risk, and those are your family and your children. And that's why there was a time period on it, you know, and that was about 2 years, funny enough. So we were out of that for 2 years. And then I had to go and get a job, is the honest. You know, I didn't have that luxury, Alan, of being saying, oh, let's start something else now. Without saying, oh, well, I'm going to have to remortgage the house or sell it or something.
Sure. Yeah, I think this part is really important. I think, you know, a large part of the premise of this entire podcast is, you know, the numbers and the financials and so on, you know, they're relevant and they're important, but it's the kind of the human experience, because we've all got our own unique experiences. We've got family situations and so on. And I mean, that's a huge leap, isn't it? When you've got young kids and you've got expectations and demands financially and otherwise, to walk away from, no doubt, what was a pretty safe and secure, probably quite a well-paid job at Vodafone. Yeah. So scary time, I'd imagine. But you backed yourself. You had confidence. Otherwise, you wouldn't have done it. But you get the important thing here was, and this is a big lesson, I think, for other potential founders or people on their journey, is it's give yourself some runway. Make sure you've got a sort of a cash buffer that you can still pay the bills and you still pay the mortgage and so on, even if it doesn't work out. thing. Yes. That's an important part. That's what you did. So then what happened after that? So you had 2 years and then you get Tesco come along and write you a check and the thing, you know, takes care of itself. Didn't make a fortune, but didn't lose your shirt, as it were. And then what? What, you go back into corporate life?
Well, I had to get back into a job for the reasons that, you know, you've just outlined as well, is that the parameters were set. I didn't have, there weren't any other savings. And I had set myself certain criteria that I was not allowed to break. Like, I'm not going to remortgage. I'm not going to take out loan to go and find. So I had to get a job I paid for. And that's when I had that moment of going, well, go back to the industry that you love. You've built up all the experience. But what you always wanted way back, kind of 1920, was to be in advertising and launch your own agency. So I went back and I wasn't able, again, after all that time, even I didn't think I was able to launch the agency straight away because I hadn't met the partners. And in my world, it's a people business, a creative business. You need people, you get paid for your ideas and the time you spend on those, developing those and producing those ideas. And I'd been out of the business for a long time. I'd built all this great experience, but I'd been out of the actual advertising world. So I felt I had to go back. So I went back and got a job as CEO of a large multinational agency in London. And then basically got back into the business to sort of, you know, reconnect with people, build back my own, you know, personal name with the industry, but still with the plan in the back of my mind that one day I would like to start my own agency. Then met some people along the way, first one and then a second partner, where I knew we would be ready to go and do that after a couple of years.
Who was the big multinational?
It was an agent, as a French network agency called Publicis, or Publicis, as you might, people might recognize over here. Yeah, so it's very large,
very well known, huge, still going strong, still successful.
Still going very strong.
Business, which obviously is,
and I was CEO of the UK business. Yeah.
UK.
So yeah, I mean that was a tough time, but it was a good time. You know, and, sorry, you carry on.
No, just you began to rebuild your network again, your contacts, your connections, and then because again, what's interesting here. Is, and everyone does things differently, it sounds to me that working with partners is important to you. Building a team of potential co-founders with you, as opposed to being a sort of solo entrepreneur and just going after things yourself, it's important to you to build other people to work alongside.
Yeah, in the world that I operate within, I think you need a combination of skills. And there's been a core, so you might have more of a management type skills, which is where I'd come from, and client relationship and partnership, making the system work and structuring it. But then there's also a big creative component, and then also what we would call a strategic component as well. And generally, there's been that triumvirate in my world. And so you wouldn't get one person that would be able physically to do all those things, but probably not. They're different makeup of characters, as you can imagine, and you need to find ones that are expert in that core capability, but also that you would be able to blend and get on with as well. So that took a bit of time, and a couple of years. But then once you find those people, then because they're people, like any partnership, they're people that you want to go out and have a beer with when things are good, but equally they're the ones you want next to you in the trenches because it's not always good, and there are some difficult times, particularly when you're starting up.
Yeah, exactly. That's that's very interesting. Just build, because everyone's got some unique skills and strengths. It's very difficult to be good at everything. So build those people who've got complementary skills. And as you say, I think that's a good measure. Could you go for a beer with somebody and still get on with them?
Completely.
And not necessarily best buddies, but be sort of professional friends as well as colleagues as well. So
I mean, they've become friends. That's right. But they weren't, they didn't set out to try and make friends with them. I set out to make sure of business with them, but they have become friends over the last, 10, 12 years.
Sure. Exactly. Okay. So the next step in the journey is getting to this point of creating, launching a business called The Corner. So talk us through that from, what was the timeline when, after you went back into corporate life and then you began to build your network again? How long were you there? And then when did the idea come from, and when did you get started with The Corner?
Well, I we launched in, I've got to get my dates right now, 2012, January 2012. And then probably at the beginning of 2011, end of 2010, I started getting frustrated with the world I was operating in. It's funny enough, somebody once said to me about entrepreneurship, and they said this years ago, they said, being an entrepreneur, you trade frustration for anxiety. And at the time, Alan, I didn't know what they were talking about. I was like, oh, yeah, whatever. That sounds like nonsense to me. And suddenly that transition around that period of leaving Publicis, and I was on gardening leave for a year, so don't tell the lawyers, but I did do some sitting in the gardening and planning what the business would be, you know. But that period, the corner, that's when I learned exactly what they meant that was about. Because all the frustrations I had about corporate life, you know, and you, there's always someone else to blame, isn't there? Someone else, another, And then you trade that for anxiety, and the anxiety of knowing, can we pay the bills? You know, can I afford to hire this person? Will that client give us another project? Why is that client going to fire us? You know, there's anxieties perpetually, and it isn't for everyone, but it would absolutely was for me. I didn't mind. I'll ride the anxiety because I prefer a world when I'm not sitting moaning and grumbling and trying to blame somebody else. But when I know, well, look, it's your responsibility, you and your partners, don't blame anyone else and deal with the anxiety and ride the highs and the lows of that. But sorry, you just reminded me. They said that to me years ago. I didn't know what they meant till then.
I've never heard that before, but it's absolutely spot on. You know, as somebody myself who's sort of done the same thing, working in big corporate life and starting your own business. And I don't think that ever leaves you really running a business. There's always an element of anxiety because you never know what's around the corner, and you can't, there's no one else to blame really. You in one hand, it's wonderful because you're in charge of your own destiny to a large extent. But so that, as you say, the frustrations drop away because you do have control. You can do more things. You're not reliant on someone else, but God, there are periods of great worry and anxiety.
Well, there are indeed. And that's, for me, I know it sounds simplistic, but maybe some of your listeners will probably maybe understand what we're talking about or appreciate it as well, is that entrepreneurs thrive on and ride that anxiety and the highs and the lows over the waves. It's not for everybody. And I understand that. And I totally respect that. And some people want more solidity, don't want the turbulence, they don't want that anxiety. But, you know, I knew then at that moment, the first few months into the corner, I knew exactly what that person had meant when they told it to me years ago. And that was great. I thought, now I understand.
Exactly. With the benefit of experience. So 2012, you get started at the corner. And what is it? It's a creative marketing
business. Yes, it's a
creative
agency. That's how you sort of founded. We're producing agency. You know, marketing communications at the corner for a whole variety of clients. And actually, you know, it is all advertising, but the definition and the meaning of that word has spread so wide now. I mean, you know, we're on a high-tech podcast here at the moment. That is one of the channels we use as a marketing advertising channel to reach out for our clients in certain instances where it's appropriate. You know, that didn't exist really years ago. It was much simpler when I joined the industry, but now it is as broad as that, and we set up an agency to be able to go, right, we can look across that whole spectrum and recommend and create content for our clients on whatever the right platform is for them. So that's what we set out to do. We didn't have any clients. We had an idea of a model, which I've just talked about, and we had ourselves in a room that someone lent us in Soho, and it began from there, really.
And what were those first early months like, months and years? I guess you were just out there trying to look for business, look for clients.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, exciting and terrifying, as most entrepreneurs will tell you. You do back yourself, which is what we talked about earlier, and you continue, and you must protect that always, because it will get knocked. Your confidence gets knocked, you get knocked back, somebody thinks you're too small, so they don't want to talk to you in those days about their account, and it is easy to get yourself down, and you have to continually drive yourself up. And that's where having partners helps. Because one day one of you may down, the other two will pull you up, and you keep driving each other forward and you keep bolstering each other. So, you know, that was a nerve-wracking time, but a fulfilling one, I suppose, because we were, you know, you're on adrenaline at the end of the day, and anything seems like an opportunity. Although one of my partners does talk about when I convinced him to join and be the third part of the business, he said I had this purple book, and it was basically all my scribbles and my plans, and then a few charts in there, there were some pages of clients. I said, well, these clients will come straight away. He said, ludicrously, I bought into that and thought that was going to happen, and not one of those clients ever materialized. But that's they're not one of them ever came. Actually, a couple came much later on. But the point is, you've got to have a point of view and a sense of direction. But I always say this to people who join as well. It's like it's the Christopher Columbus mentality. I know there's land over there, and we're going to set sail in this direction. And again, it's not linear. We're going to move around or whatever, but I know there's land there, and trust me, get on board and we'll find it. And there was an element of that at the end of the day, but we picked up some business, some people that I had known, back to having the contacts. It's a people world and it's a contacts world. And there are people, even to this day, you know, last week, there was someone that I used to work with who worked for me at my time at Adidas, who called up and went, who's now in a marketing job. And he said, oh, Neil, I want, you know, can you get your guys to take a look at this? Of course we will. But even back there, he's reaching out as I did, and you know, just, and you probably do, someone that you know and trust, you know, will deliver, won't let you down. Go there straight away, you know, and that's where those relationships came through for me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yes, and like yours, ours is a people business, and I had a call this week from someone I knew 25 years ago.
There you go.
When you do the advantage of putting miles on the clock, because we've been around for a few years, so we all know people that go back, and it can be beneficial for business. Was the when you launched the business, did you launch it with a kind of an exit in mind? Did you say we'll build it for a number of years and we'll look for an exit and a sale? Was that from the start, or was that something that evolved over time?
You know, that is the eternal question. Everybody asks that. It may have been in the back of our minds because, you know, the agency world, a lot of agencies start and there's you see them sell. It's perpetual. It's an oversupplied market and lots are coming out as the latest, greatest, brightest new thing. And many then get to sell, not as many as people think in truth, and flip on and disappear. We didn't talk about that. You know, it was there. We didn't. And I think that's quite important. You know, I've always felt we didn't create a business to sell. You know, I think we created a business to feed our passion is the truth. And therefore, as a result, we ended up creating something that was actually attractive to someone, because it just has to be attractive to one person. In the end, it was attractive to a few people, but that's what it is. And I deeply think, certainly in our world with the creative business, if you all the time, every decision you're made is around a final sale, that will impact on the quality of the product you're actually creating and therefore make it less attractive at the end of the day to a potential acquirer. Because all the way along, you're going to be thinking, well, I'm not going to invest in that. I'm not going to spend more money on that individual, or I'm not going to spend too much money going after that client. You'd be making decisions like that rather than, as we did, going, right, we're going to have to invest in the best quality people we can. We're going to have to invest behind going after this client because there's more, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We want to get a nicer office, so we're going to have to invest an outlay on that, as we did at one stage, because we want clients to be comfortable and have space when they come in. We want our people to have a nice working environment. All those things, you know, had we been looking to sell from an early stage, we would have been far tighter on investment. And I think that would have impacted us and not made us as attractive as a product. So we didn't look to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah. Obviously we're going to come on to what happened.
But as you say, as a consequence of all that, and just looking after your team, you know, creating a good environment, reinvesting in yourselves, you eventually you create something which, indeed, as you say, is very attractive to other people, potential buyers.
Yeah.
So talk us through that then. At some point, what happened? Did your phone ring, or did somebody contact you, or was it more something that you reached out to? What was the initial process that went through, which resulted in you selling?
Yeah. So it was probably, so we'd set up. Well, interestingly, actually, we had an approach. So we set up, as I said, in, what do we know, 2012, and we had an approach within 2 years from an American agency, a successful American agency, saying, we want to buy you. I mean, they even flew us out to the US. And I said all along, I'm, you know, to them, I said, I'm slightly concerned, you know, that... You know, it's wonderful and it's flattering, and you've flown us out into the US. But you know, the price we might want if we're going to give up our hard fought independence and our agency, fledgling agency or business we created, is probably not what you're going to want. Oh, don't worry about that. We'll come up with a figure. I mean, in the end, it went to their financiers, and their owners were out of Japan, and you will understand this as well. And they looked at the numbers of our business and basically came back with something that was, you know, a pittance in terms of what we perceived the value was. But they were right, because you calculate it and go, well, actually, what is your Well, there's your revenue at the end of the day, but your margin's tiny. What you actually make, your EBIT's low, you know, a smaller amount, whatever it may be. And so we politely declined that. And that was our first experience of it. Again, not looking for it at all, came out the blue. But I said to the partners at the time, and I think it was useful, I said, you know, because they didn't want to sell, neither did I. Like I said, you're hard for independence. Suddenly, with under 2 years, you're going to just sell it and give it all away again, go back to that corporate life. No. But I said, let's go through the process, because this will be interesting for us to understand the reality of the sort of thing that's going to happen. So it was interesting little test run. Then Ripple Dissolve, again, as I said, we weren't looking to sell. It must have been around 2016. We got contact, and it was through an intermediary who said, I'm acting on behalf of an acquirer. They're looking at buying a creative agency. And again, my view was nothing to lose from listening and finding out who it is, you know, at the end of the day and putting in. So I submitted a credentials document on us, didn't hear anything, and then came back and said they of all the ones they've received, they picked three they want to see. They had informal meetings with the three, then there's one they wanted to progress, and that was us. But this went on for over a year because we were doing well at that time. And normally you are doing well when somebody comes knocking on the door. You know, you're not doing badly necessarily.
This is the challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're doing well, you get approached. But then on the other hand, you're probably enjoying it because you're successful and you're winning more business and so on. So this is the trade-off, isn't it? It's this sort of between the two.
So we were being wooed. Well, we were being wooed for about a year. Yeah. And it was, it didn't happen to me. I'm normally the other way around chasing something. But this time we were being wooed. And that was good. And we asked a lot of the right questions at the time, but I'll come on to that because it's very interesting what you get told then and what the reality is further down the line. But eventually things began to accelerate after a year, and we entered into that phase of going, yeah, okay, we'll actively entertain this, in which case we have to disclose our books, and we begin the process of getting to an offer. I didn't, I'm relatively naive on this, never having been through it before. And again, people you've spoken to on your podcast, a lot of people listening who have or haven't experienced it, I suddenly realized what is entailed in selling a business is way more than I expected. It takes way longer than I expected. And goodness me, there are a lot of advisors that appear that you have to engage and pay for as well.
Yes, indeed.
And if I was going to, things I remember now, looking back on it, and we did pay due diligence, actually, thankfully we did. But looking back on it, I would say to myself, lawyers are critical. Those meetings are going to be long and tedious, but pay attention, Neil. Pay attention very carefully to the wording. That's a big learning.
So you hired some good lawyers?
Yeah, we had good.
Happy with them.
Had lawyers. Very happy with the lawyers. Very happy. We had a financial advisor as well. So it's these multiple people. I didn't think we would. We had a very good. And I'd hired a CFO and actually, made him a small equity partner right at the beginning of the business. And creative agencies don't really do that. They think, just hire a junior FD. My goodness me, I'm glad I did hire that guy because he came to the fore during the sale process and was very experienced and represented us in a lot of meetings. I couldn't go to everything. It was drawing my time away from the core business and my partners too much. But he went to those. And also, towards the end, tax advisors as well. I mean, this is, probably you're much more familiar with this world than I am, Alan, but that was important. We'd set up early on because we'd taken advice when we actually set the formulation of the corner to ensure we had entrepreneurs relief. And that made a massive difference because suddenly, I'm sure you've had this on your podcast. I think you did have one gentleman talking about gross and net. And entrepreneurs get carried away thinking, look at that big figure on the bit of paper. By the time the inner revenue is finished with it, it's not that big figure.
Yes. And all the fees that are going out as well, because you've got this sort of, this army of professionals surrounding you sort of doing what needs to be done. But they tend not to come cheap, these people. You had good experiences. Can we share who the lawyers were? Give it. Positive message.
There was a guy called Tim Burt, and he's at Osborne Clark, and he does specialize in that media world, but I don't mind giving him a shout out because he was definitely use him again in a heartbeat, but a very, very good chat. And he specializes in media, but not just in the media world, but really useful and thankfully could explain things to me in a way that I understood, i.e. in layman's terms.
Yeah, no, sure. And because it is complex, and having sort of dipped my own toe in that water, there's words and language and jargon that is just, it's alien. You never come across it before. And all of a sudden, you're just having to get familiar because, as you say, this stuff is important. All of a sudden, your entire kind of, you know, business and future is at stake. And so you don't want to make a mistake by, you know, not reading the contract appropriately.
That's
so
right. That's
surround
right,
yourself
Alan.
With good advisors, I think, is good advice.
100%. 100%. And, you know, yes, negotiate on their terms and their fees, because everybody's there to be negotiated on. And don't just settle on the numbers, but make sure you get the best you can around you. Because that point you just, the word you just said, Alan, about future is important. Because this sale process, certainly in my experience, was not just a sale process which finishes there. The shutter comes down and that's it. There's your check. Goodbye. Off into the sunset. There was an earnout period, as there is for a lot of entrepreneurs. And that can be, you know, a minimum two, up to 5 years, let's say. You know, in our case, it was three. That's quite a long time. So look carefully at the wording of what is incorporated in those 3 years. What is expected of you? How you're supposed to behave? What you can and can't do? You know, that don't just ignore that and think it's just a sale that finishes at this point.
No, exactly. And we should we'll go into that in a second. Of the actual process, you said it took longer than you were expecting. How long did it take from sort of the first point of contact to when you completed?
Well, we were courted for a year. And then I would say it took the actual sale itself from the process that I'd probably say 7 to 8 months after that, because there was a lot of legality. And it transpired that the acquirer, and I didn't realize this completely, but the way they were funding it was to go out and raise the funds. So they didn't have they weren't liquid. They didn't have the funds sitting there. They went out to raise the funds. And I hadn't realized that at the beginning. Maybe I should have done, but I hadn't realized that. That took a bit of period because, of course, they then had to go out, and that took them a couple of months to go out and raise the funds to make the acquisition.
Yeah, and I think this is another important point. Did you do much in the way of due diligence on the buyer? Did you explore them and
very
ask
good
them
question.
Lots of tough questions? Because this is the key thing, because if they, because you've either got ones who are already well-funded, they've got deep pockets and able to buy, or, as you say, they haven't got the money, they have to go and raise it, and that can be subject to change, and their own funders might pull the plug. Current, you know, market circumstances today are different to what they were a year ago. So what if anything, did you do on the prospective purchaser at the time?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alan. So the individual who was lead, it was a new group. It was a new constellation. They'd acquired four businesses already. We were the fifth agency, all different agencies with different skills. I knew that individual from our, he was a well-known, respected and well-known individual from the world of advertising and marketing. So that made a difference. And I got to know him quite well. We met the other four businesses before we even agreed to begin disclosing our own books. We met all of those. And so from that perspective, we knew there was certainly felt like a cultural fit. The ambition and vision that was set out was aligned to ours. We were able to keep our own name and our office space and cultural identity. And I fought to keep those, very important for a later conversation that we'll come on to. But that I fought to keep early on, yeah. which was good. What I didn't do, perhaps, was consider enough about the financial makeup of the business, what you're alluding to there, the other part of that due diligence. Mm. It was a new group, so there wasn't a lot of history to it. They'd only been going a couple of years, and they'd acquired four businesses rapidly. But in hindsight, if I'd realized, you know, the whole business model was based on raising funds in the city, I might have asked a couple more questions on that. Because if your growth is predicated on acquisition, fine, which is what the business model was. But if your acquisition is predicated on raising the money in the city, you've got to make sure there's going to be a steady supply of that. And if there isn't, and that dries up, you're in serious trouble. And I'm afraid that's sort of what happened.
Right. Okay. Yes, exactly. It is interesting. What, without necessarily going into the detail of the numbers, is there a traditional model for valuing companies in your sector? Is there a multiple of EBITDA? What tends to be the sort of broad price valuation range?
Yeah, it is a multiple of EBITDA from my experience. I've only had, you know, limited experience by myself and from talking to some other people. You wouldn't get someone saying, okay, you know, I'll give you 2x revenue, 2.5, 3x revenue, whatever. You'll generally get a range, I guess, of, and it varies, but 7 to 9 as a multiple was a period. And actually now that might even be less, you know, and I think you'd know this very well, you know, the multiples, it's not as case of saying, right, there's a 7.5 and that's fixed at an infinitum. It's going up and down. And the multiple at the moment could be even more like between 6 and 7. Of what you may get at the moment in our world on EBITDA.
Yeah, I guess it does. It depends on prevailing economic conditions. If it's, you know, the cost of capital, as we know, for a decade has been very, very low. So people are able to raise money at sort of very low interest rates, which helps valuations. You can afford to pay a bit more to buy a business if the cost of funding the debt to buy it is lower. But interest rates obviously gone up recently. So that the likely knock-on effect for businesses across the board is that valuations will come off a bit. And that's certainly happening, certainly in the tech space that I've observed. So they come up with a valuation. What did you do anything yourself personally? Did you ever sort of calculate what sort of a relevant financial number payout looks like to you personally? I mean, I call it the magic number. This idea is, well, if I got X, then I'll be financially secure. I wouldn't necessarily need to keep working. Or did you go through an exercise to identify?
We did as partners to try and work that out and go, what would we want out of this? And marry that with a realistic appreciation of what we think the valuation of our business was. And clearly we made the sale, so we were comfortable. And generally, if you make a sale, it means both buyer and vendor are happy with the number they land at. So we did. I think, well, I'll come on to the nature of construction of the deal because it's relevant, I talked about earnout before. You know, it isn't, here's all the cash up front. You get a lump sum, and then over a period of time, more will be released, subject to business performance, which is generally the rule of thumb in our world, over 3 years. And then you'll make up the number. Equally alongside that was an award in terms of shares in this new entity, which, you know, that could be, well, that's a bit of a rise or fall. I mean, at the time, naively, I was told, well, this is going to be worth X million. So the shares, that's going to be, you know, in the end, they weren't. They were worth a pittance of what we'd been promised. But the shares would have been the value. So really, it's the deal in the entirety. What I did do, which was good, is I made sure I could get as much as possible in cash up front. And goodness me, I'm glad I did do that as a percentage of the total deal. Because in hindsight, and some things none of us could have been prepared for. You know, we're talking about a period where there was a whole Brexit debate. There was an element of recession around that time. We remember they were factors we couldn't have foreseen. I mean, goodness me, I didn't know we would. Well, that's political now. I don't know if this podcast is political, but I wouldn't have voted to leave the European Union. Is my personal view.
say what you want, but I think, but the point being, and this is, I think this is relevant as well to the sort of entrepreneurial journey. There are things beyond all our control. In fact, you know, this idea of kind of once in a lifetime events seem to happen every year right now. So, which is another sort of spanner in the works sometimes for businesses, particularly with going through a sale and exit. Because I think this is the crux of the issue, and I think this is where your story, as I understand it, and please talk about it now, takes a different turn. Because it's not necessarily, as I understand it, a complete, we shook hands, we did the deal, we all, you know, we got some money, we lived happily ever after. Things then took a different turn. So let's talk through that thing, because you're then going through an earnout.
Right? Yes, we are, Alan. So we're going through the earnout, different economic times, difficult economic times for everybody. And that puts pressure, back to what I talked about in the city, on the person that was at the helm of this new group, who had the vision and put this new advertising agency group together. You know, he has to issue a profits warning. At the first profit warning, as they always used to tell me, and this happened, the CFO goes. The second one, the CEO goes. He was out. And that was, you know, that's probably my first taste in boardrooms of the nature of, you know, if you don't deliver, if you've made promises to the city and you don't deliver, it's about numbers. Don't talk about jam tomorrow and possible this, possible that. So that's what it's about. And a fair dues. That's what the deal was. So the business started to change then straight away, is that there was suddenly it was being run by people who didn't understand the nature of the business we operated within, and so decisions were not being made in an appropriate way, as you know, the other founders, original founders of the five businesses that were involved in it were. Anyway, what that led to was, and things, you know, didn't improve, you know, and et cetera. And even down to, you know, and we're just talking coming up to now, slightly pre-COVID, that, you know, things not great all round. So there was what you might call a fire sale of the whole group. Some of the shareholders, some of the city were going, we don't want this anymore. We just want to do this. Let's get rid of it. So what I had bought into and done a deal in December 2017, I and my two partners, what happened? None of that materialized. We were made promises that didn't materialize. The individuals that had said that, oh, yeah, we'll do this, were out. were booted out of the business. And the value that we thought we were going to realize individually, certainly from a share price, the share price had sunk through the floor, you know, and was nowhere near the millions that we'd been promised it was going to be. So there wasn't, you know, we were facing sort of slightly unpleasant circumstance when actually you're also on a, I don't know, it's not the Titanic, but it's a large ocean liner where you're just a captain of a deck, and it's now there's going to be a whole set of new owners. We're just going to fire sell to somewhere else. And this is now the beginning of 2020, I would say, when suddenly I thought, and it's way back to what I told you right at the beginning of my career, when the careers are not linear and things change and be ready for something to jump up, I suddenly thought, I can't go with this. I can't go with this being bounced to another entity that's going to own us. Decisions are being made not in the interest of our people and our clients. And we've always made decisions for our people and our clients. Keep those two entities happy and constituents happy, and generally you'll be running a pretty tight, sound ship. I just said to my two partners, I said, we've got to find a way out of this. This isn't going to work. And I couldn't stop the larger deal because they'd found an acquirer who was very keen to do it right pre-COVID. And I think it was being backed by LDC, was their funding, and they scrapped all their other bids because, you know, we're now talking kind of March 2020. They scrapped everything. I went, no, we're going to keep buying that one because it's cheap. So I couldn't stop that deal, but I could slow it down and make it all slightly awkward. So in the end, I just said, look, you know, they came to me and said, what do you want? I said, I want to buy it back. I'll buy out of this. I'll buy out of the deal.
Right.
So we bought the agency back. My two partners and I hadn't planned that. But we're back in the world of entrepreneur, and that's unusual in our world. Normally, agency people sell their agency and they're gone, you know, as close to a beach as they can find somewhere in the world, and adios. But no, we bought it back because at the end of the day, I thought, I've got to have some integrity. I've stood up in front of our people and they've been buffeted and had an unpleasant time. And some of our clients have said it'd be better and it hasn't been better. And I thought, for them, but also for my own personal satisfaction, enjoyment, working life, I'm not ready to finish working. I want to keep doing it. I've got some pride in the business that we set up, and it's not behaving as we wanted it to behave. So we have a chance. Not everyone gets that chance. You know, you hear some entrepreneurs coming back to businesses later on because culturally they've changed and they want to re-inject you with what the original founder had. But in our world, you don't often get the chance to buy back your business at a reduced price, I might say, which is good.
That is what I was going to ask about. You bought it back at a discount. Sell it for £1 and buy it for 50p. I like your style. How did you fund the purchase then? Did you use the resources that you'd had from the sale?
Good question. I funded it because one of the things I'd got written down during the early part of the deal, which again was important, was a guaranteed earnout. So a threshold, whereas things started to change after the original, we got a guaranteed earnout figure, slightly reduced from what we want, but a guaranteed number. That bit of paper became very useful in the negotiation to buy back, because what I'd decided to do was basically, it was a paper deal. I basically traded this guaranteed earnout for the business back, because otherwise, if we'd gone along with the sale, they would still have had to honour that piece of paper and pay the three of us our guaranteed earnout as part of the acquisition. And the acquirer didn't want to do that, clearly. Mm.
So they just effectively escalated or brought forward the guaranteed payout that they were going to have. They were contractually obliged to pay you over the next several years, two or three years after that. And just
traded that, buy
it back
for equal to the value of that. So it didn't cost us incremental capital, which I was quite relieved about, because we didn't have a lot of that spare. And back to your point earlier about your personal life, didn't want to impact on that.
Sure, exactly. So, well, that's where you are now, right? You're back, back in business, independent business, entrepreneurial life,
entrepreneurial
more anxiety,
life.
Traded for frustration, all that stuff.
Yeah, completely, but happy. But yes, I think that's right, Alan. I think I am back there. We had to spend a year rebuilding the business culturally and with a turnover of people, because there's been a talent migration in all sectors. And that, because what you buy back, you know, I joke, yes, it was cheaper than what we sold it for a couple of years earlier, but it had been buffeted around. It wasn't the same product and business we were buying back, damaged a bit, and we had to rebuild it. We spent a year doing that, and which is last year. We're in a much more even keel now, and a lot more positivity around the momentum of the business and a good atmosphere and culturally stronger. So I'm really pleased with where we are. And I think what I got, you know, during this process, because it'll be unusual compared to a lot of your entrepreneurs who will have made, you know, a lot more money than me and disappeared. I mean, I'm still happy and have a smile on my face, which is an important thing at the end of the day. And also, I had that period in between where it wasn't maybe the absolute maximum amount of wealth that I would have wanted to generate from a sale moment. But I'm back in the game and may have the opportunity of another sale moment at another stage. But I did have a moment when I made, you know, some money that cleared some debts from before, and that I think bought me time, I suppose, Alan, is interesting. Yeah. Bought me time from that first sale. You know, people say, what did you buy? What did you buy? You know, so did you get a watch? Did you get a new car? Did you get any? There were some trappings like that, but I always think time is the thing it got me. Sure. It got me time to make a decision about what I want to work on today, you know, what I want to do. And then time, yes, for your family, because we talked about that as an underlying theme through, because they're the ones that are there that support you when you want to go off and do these mad entrepreneurial things. They're always there, you know, picking you up and maybe putting up with your slightly grumpy mood, etc. And also, the other thing I'd say is time for your health. I mean, you know, you and I both try and go to the gym every now and again. That's so important. And yeah. Back to those earlier years of my career, I was doing breakfast, lunch, dinner with clients every day. I wasn't going to the gym. I was traveling and flying a lot. I wasn't sleeping particularly well. I wasn't looking after myself in any way, shape, or form. And because you're younger, you think, oh, I could just ride this. This is the life. And what I have to do is throw myself into work even harder than I am doing to be more successful, to try and be, if I have any chance of being successful. And actually, what I've learned, and maybe the entrepreneur, maybe that sale moment bought me a bit of time to realize that health part, your own health, is equally as important as anything.
So important.
Sorry, I went off on a tangent again there, didn't right. I?
No. But this is exactly what we need to be talking about in this, because right. You know, a deal is a deal, and sometimes they work, and sometimes they don't. And there's you know, your experiences are fascinating, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned. But there's some fundamentals that exist there. Two things I think absolutely: health is the most important thing. You know, your family and your health, and making sure you show up every day feeling positive, feeling energized, so you can throw yourself into your work and be the best version of yourself. And that doesn't happen by accident, for sure. And also just, you know, from our conversations in the past, you seem very energized. So you seem sort of positive, you're smiling, you've got your mojo back, and perhaps it was lost a little bit going through that big transaction and realizing that on one side of things, the money and the financials, they are important, of course. That's creating your economic security for yourself and your family going forward. But it has to be married with you know, your own frame of mind. You want to be able to show up at work, enjoying it, you know, loving the work you do, loving your people, loving your clients, and giving your best self. And so, you know, a big lesson there was, because of circumstances beyond your control, beyond a lot of people's control, it's just one of these things. It's back to the, you know, the frogger or the snakes and ladders. You slid down a snake there for a point, and now you're climbing up the ladder again, but with a lot more experience. You know, the next time something else comes along, you'll be a little bit more wiser and be able to sort of go again. Well, looking back on it, I mean, what were the biggest lessons of that whole thing? Because you've kind of gone full circle. You're now, you know, back in the game, running your business, excited and energized, but looking back over the last couple of years, what were the takeaways for you?
Well, that's a good. I mean, we've touched on a few of them. Biggest lessons. Yeah, we touched on some. I mean, maybe I fought against myself from being too excited during the early part of the sale process and taking everything at face granted. I fought hard against myself. I said, don't be naive. Question everything. Interrogate it. Make sure it's robust for the longer term. And I thought I'd done that. I think I hadn't done it as much maybe as I should have done. And I took a couple of things at face value that I should have interrogated more. It sounds naive, and I went into this thing, but it's almost you can't do enough of that, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Really interrogate it to make sure it's right for you. Having said that, there were a couple of things that I did, you know, I did get right and hung on to, which benefited us later on, which I'm pleased about in terms of, as I said, protecting the business name and maintaining that, because when you came to buy it back, I could actually buy it back. Had that morphed into something else and disappeared, you know, extracting that business would have been much harder. It was much easier to extract it because I'd left, it's almost like I'd left a parachute kit just in case, you know, and that was my parachute kit just in case. And I don't mean to be a pessimist about any of these, but in hindsight, it's like, that was a good bit of advice to myself. Excuse me, have a parachute? What if this does go pear-shaped? What is your way out of this? And again, I don't want to be pessimistic or negative about it, but things, you know, shit happens. So be ready for that, you know, if it can.
Exactly.
I think, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, because based on what you said, they're part of the consideration, the payment or the payout was going to be in shares and equity of this larger company. Again, I've spoken to a few people in the past, you know, expert M&A experts, and they've always said to me, look, just if that happens, it's a bonus. Assume you're going to get nothing if it's equity. What you get in cash is what you can rely on. Anything above that is a bonus. Let's hope it happens, but you don't rely on it because the numbers can be, you know, very appealing. It becomes telephone numbers. If we do this, if we hit this valuation, you know, we're all going to be wealthy beyond our wildest dreams. And it's rare that actually happens.
Well, that was, maybe you and I should have had that chat then. I mean, I should have known that. I didn't, but it's hard not to get seduced by, you know, as you said, a big telephone number at the end and saying, look, and by the way, we haven't even talked about all these other millions you're going to get. Well, they're not. You're not going to get them unless you guarantee the share price, you know. But you can't help but be seduced and think, well, that'd be good if that came in. Then I really would, you know. I think what's interesting about me at the moment, and you talked about energy, is I don't think I was also not in the position of going, right, this is me done. I do want to disappear. That's me finished work. I just want to be sit in my garden or I want to go to the beach because I enjoy work. I enjoy my work. You know, the nature of what I do transitions a lot now. The older I get, the more I focus as CEO of creating the environment that's right for all the smart, talented young people that work at the corner to deliver their best possible work and enjoy working in the business. And so I'm less maybe more of a doer. I'm more of creating that environment more now, certainly the second time around, and ensuring that it runs as smoothly as them so they're able to do their best work. And being, you know, you talked about energy and being positive, you know, being up. Being honest and transparent with all the people all the time. And that's another learning that's come out of this is that even if it's not good and there's bad news, sharing that, I mean, maybe not every single bit of, you know, financial minutiae, but certainly sharing the news with people and giving an honest interpretation of why we've made this decision. Or we're thinking of doing this and this. Let's have an open conversation now with everybody in the room. Where's your feeling? And then I will tell you what decision we're going to make, whatever.
That's so important. So important. And I'm just going to pick up just briefly on what you said there, Neil, because this is, I have to say, quick aside, this is the landmark episode of the podcast. This is our 10th podcast.
And is it? Congratulations.
I heard something the other day I know it was some very, very early days, but apparently 90% of podcasts ever launched never get past 9 episodes. So hooray for us. This is the 10th when we publish it. But I think it's a, you know, small number so far, but already there's an emerging theme coming through, speaking to business owners and entrepreneurs who've gone through various journeys. Some have exited successfully, some have, you know, different set of circumstances. But this thing about, you know, life after work, the work is far more than a paycheck for a business owner and an entrepreneur. There's a lot more to it. And certainly, you know, one or two of the previous episodes, there have been some business owners who exited successfully financially, who then went to a pretty dark place. It wasn't an enjoyable period of their life, and then they only emerged from that when they engaged in a further, you know, entrepreneurial endeavor, set up a new business or got involved with another company or something. So I think that's part of we'll probably come back to that in future episodes. Just you know, knowing that you've got something to go towards and you're financially secure. You've got something to do every day. You've got a purpose. You've got a reason to leap out of bed in the morning and get on with your day, as opposed to, another day on the beach or on the golf course or something. So
that's such an important point. I mean, I would say that. I hadn't wanted to disappear because I enjoy my work. But the difficulty for these entrepreneurs that you talk to and the people that, you know, listen to your podcast is it defines you so much and it's driven you so much through all of your time. And of course, we're all very conscious and aware of work-life balance. And, you know, we talked about family a lot and their importance in this and nothing that your work life to the detriment of your family's happiness and development and, you know, and success together. But when you take it away and you say, that's it, I've sold, I've got them away, that was done. It's very hard to replace that for an entrepreneur as well who was so driven and passionate about what they were doing. But I hadn't wanted to stop working. I did always want, we talked about time earlier, I think the value to me is always, you know, the ability to be able to get up and decide what you're going to do this week And I don't ever see a moment of retirement. I mean, I had a conversation about it. It's very interesting, the nature of retirement. And again, you probably talk about this a lot more than I do. But you look at it ahead, and I look at my father and my grandfathers, and this notion that it's a dead stop. But certainly for an entrepreneur, there is no dead stop. I mean, that's an awful concept to me. That's terrifying. That would be a dead stop. And then what am I doing now? Should I better have a hobby? You know, and that's a bit what happened to my dad. Yeah. Like, oh, God, I don't know. Am I supposed to play golf? I don't know what I'm supposed to do, because he'd worked all his life. Then it was an immediate stop. I don't see that. There's much more of a tapering now in the way I see world. And the value of potential wealth or some sort of small wealth is the ability to give you that decision to decide. And realize now that the experience you built up, to pick up another theme from all of this, is quite valuable to other people as they're starting out an entrepreneurial life or even just working in the corporate or whatever. And people have approached me separately saying, oh, if you ever do stop and you might do some consultancy, it's a little, maybe it's a bit of non-exec, or you just do a bit of, you know, would you give me some consultancy? I'd pay you a day a week or 2 days a month, whatever. I could see myself potentially doing some of that rather than stopping everything straight like that.
Sure. No, exactly. Kind of portfolio lifestyle, the number of different interesting engagements. You may have just answered this, but the question I ask everyone on this is this sort of concept of true wealth. So if I was to say to you, you know, we know wealth, and wealth often people relate it to money, but I think that there's the essence of an entrepreneur seems to be somewhat different. If I was to ask you that question, and as I say, you may have already, but you certainly have alluded to it. Yeah. What does true wealth mean to you, Neil?
Well, I think I did just touch on it as well. So for me, that's the control of your time is the way I always defined it to myself, and not a material possessions or trappings. I just have to find it as control of your time. And some people will say, you know, happiness, which is, of course, but to me, that's a consequence. Because if I have control of my time, I can engineer what is most happy to me, which will be more time with family, seeing them develop and be successful and following their particular passions and hobbies. You know, more time to be able to devote to ensure your own personal health. So you are, I think you said this earlier, you are, you're better able to give your best all the time to the people that matter to you, you know. And that's how I define and always have done. For a long time, it was about the decision control of your time, the ability to wake up and go, actually, do you know what? I'm not going to work today. I'm going to go to see that exhibition that I really wanted to see because I can, you know. And on most of my working life, I've not been able to do that. I've been getting up going, I need to get there fast because I've got to get that for that meeting, and that's got to go. And I've laughed. But that control of time, that's what true wealth delivers to me.
Very well said. I couldn't agree with you more. That the ability to, as you say, when you wake up in the morning, kind of within reason, decide what you're going to do. That's so powerful, and I try to embrace that myself. Neil, this has been a fantastic conversation. As we wind our way towards the end of it, what about have there been any resources that you find helpful? Or, you know, whether, I don't know if you are a reader, reading books or other podcasts or films or anything that's sort of inspired you or you've learned from that others might benefit from?
Well, I'm looking around my office here because there are thousands of books and there's two whole shelves of business books. I don't think any of those, to be honest. And I'm not supposed to say that. Do you know...
No, you are.
Because, I mean, I've read a lot of them. Some of them aren't even read, and they're up there in the big presence, and I have to admit I've not read them. But all I would say, I sort of alluded to it when I talked about going to a gallery. Maybe I work in a creative business, so I have to keep doing that. And, of course, you know, I think... The way I try and inspire myself is creating the space to do things that are absolutely nothing to do with my working life. And I know that sounds obvious, but if you think about your working life, and I went through long periods of this where really I worked and I was then with my family and I slept, and that was 7 days a week. And when I was with my family, it was like maybe when some of the younger were just getting through. I was getting through weeks. And now I try and make sure, sometimes with family, if I can, you know, drag them along, or actually go with what they want. And it might be sporting events with my sons, or it might be other things with my young daughter now, or my partner, my wife now. And even as myself, it's like I'm going to go and have 2 hours going around that gallery, as I said earlier, or we're going to sit and we're going to go to the theatre and we're going to sit and we've got something lined up now. I make a point of putting these things in for us. It's not really a good answer to your question, Alan, but that is how I get my inspiration.
Perfect. It's a perfect answer, because it's where you get your inspiration from. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think about that more myself, just doing something, because most of our professional lives were wrapped up with it. Even a lot of the people that we meet and we associate and friends are from the same profession. And then to do something right, which is entirely different, particularly when you're in the creative sector, and you need to be inspired. You need to see and experience other things. So whether that's a gallery, as you say, theater, movie, whatever it might be. And if you can blend it with your family, then it's even better. So I think that's a great response. And I would say to any entrepreneur, go out and do something you wouldn't normally do. Get out of your comfort zone a bit and go and experience something. Particularly if you're in this part of the world and the country, London and the Southeast, there are no shortage of opportunities to go and do and experience things. So that's great advice. No, it really has been. This has been definitely a different type of conversation. It hasn't been the classic founder, build, scale, exit, happily ever after. I mean, none of them are. Every story is obviously unique in its own way. But this has been a fascinating, and I'm really grateful to you for sharing your story with me and with the listeners. People are going to get an awful lot from this. If, Neil, somebody wanted to reach out and connect with you, what's the best way of contacting you?
The corner website, my LinkedIn, you'll find me as Neil Simpson on LinkedIn. It's probably a common name. Or my email, neil.simpson@thecornerlondon.com. Very happy for people to reach out to me if they wish. And I've really, it's just been great. I've enjoyed it. You know what? Just sitting talking to you for an hour, and I've remembered a lot of things, reminded myself of some of the things I learned. I'm like, yes, must do that again. Must do more of that.
Exactly. No, it's wonderful. And this is the one of the things I'm getting from this podcast. As I say, we're still very early in the journey, but there's a network. We've all been on similar journeys one way or another. And I'm a big fan of, in my own career, you know, the phrase standing on the shoulders of giants. When I was younger, there was older people that came along, and they really helped me. They pointed me in the right direction. They told me, the mistakes they'd made. And it's on that basis that I wanted to sort of keep this whole thing going, because, we are a crazy bunch of people, band of brothers and sisters that all, anyone who sort of gives up the guarantee of a paycheck and goes and starts their own company. First of all, in some ways they need their heads tested, but it can be a fantastic and highly rewarding journey, but there are bumps in the road. And I think we all learn from each other. If we share our stories and our best practices and things, the mistakes we made and things we do differently, then it'd be, it makes a kind of whole entrepreneurial experience, hopefully a more positive one for others. So Neil Simpson, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate that and all your words of wisdom. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Alan. Bye.
Thanks for making it this far. I hope you found this episode to be helpful. If so, I'd like to ask you for a small favor. Can you please go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review, as that's one of the best ways for others to find it. And please send a link to the podcast to 3 friends or colleagues who you know will find it helpful. That way we can spread the word and everyone can benefit. All the show notes and links from every episode can be found at www.entrepreneurtransition.com. Thanks again for tuning in and being part of our community. I'll see you next time.